Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the New Books Network channel in sociology. I'm the host, Richard Osijo of the City University of New York, and I'm joined today by Christopher Mealy, associate professor of sociology at the University of Buffalo. And he's going to tell us a little bit about his new book, Race and the Politics of Deception, The Making of an American City. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
Great. So I wanted you to start by telling us just a little bit about your biography, your personal background, professional background, some work that you've previously done before this book.
Okay. Well, right now I am currently a professor at the University of Buffalo in sociology department, and I've been there since the mid-90s. My beginning roots in urban sociology were at the New School for Social Research, which was a great place to be in the late 80s, early 90s. I studied under Janet Abulugad and Charles Tilly, Ira Katznelson, a bunch of other really good urbanists. My dissertation was on the Lower East Side that eventually became part of a much bigger project that led to my book in 2000 from Minnesota, Selling the Lower East Side. And in some odd ways, this recent book on race and politics deception is a sort of continuation of a broad theme on the role of representation in the political economy of urban development. So that's basically what my gig is. I spend most of my time doing case studies of particular areas within cities like New York or cities themselves like Chester and Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia, and also in Camden. And I'm about to finish up some work this summer on an area called Regent Park in Toronto. So I guess I'm an old school urbanist that likes to do community studies.
Yeah, that's great. So you just mentioned Chester, which is the case that you focus on in this book. So I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit about the city and how you came to write this book about Chester.
Right. So I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. I guess I left there for graduate school. So I went to the University of Delaware for my undergraduate degree. I left the region about the late 80s. And at that time, Chester, which sits between Wilmington and Philadelphia off of Interstate 95. Also, the Amtrak line flashes through there on its way on the Northeast Corridor. And Chester had loomed large in my childhood as a place I'd never had really visited, but had always heard about. Wilmington shares the Philadelphia media market, so any kind of discussions about mostly terrible things that were happening, vast fires, abandonment, crime, and things of that nature that makes for typical news media coverage, made it into the Wilmington area. And so it was really a kind of a place that people were told to avoid as much as possible who did not live there. It wasn't until much later, when I returned about 10 years ago, to do some elder care with my parents, that I ventured into Chester, primarily through taking my mother up to what was then the opening of Harrah's Casino. So Chester had immediately struck me as this kind of hodgepodge of what's best described still as kind of experiments in neoliberal urban development, in the sense that within a short strip of about a half a mile, you'll find a casino, a prison, two waste to energy incinerators, a soccer stadium, all along a kind of repurposed waterfront. Again, cheek by jowl, very close to each other, within, if one were to walk, within minutes of each other. And I found that this was, my first impression as an urban sociologist, that this was a example of neoliberalism in the sense of private partner and public partnerships that were, in essence, building deal-making efforts along this abandoned waterfront, with no forethought as to how these are linked together, and more importantly, what impact, if any, they had on the broader community that sat across the industrial highway, the city of Chester proper itself, which was and is majority African American, close to 80%, and majority poor. So this was my inroads, and I wrote about this in a few articles about the kind of significance of this kind of deal making, in which the eye is not on the ball of urban development in some broader historical sense, but more on essentially mustering the financial capital, the political will to construct these sort of icons to neoliberalism, in the sense that they really don't have much to do with or relate to each other, and then move on to something else. So within a short period of 10 years, these things that I mentioned had all popped up and essentially touted as the way to rescue Chester from its deindustrialized past.
Yeah, interesting. So you really present this contrast between what you just described about Chester's redevelopment, and that is the casino, the waterfront, the soccer stadium, and then the rest of the city, which, as you mentioned, is predominantly black and poor. And you really use this contrast to present what you call this ideology of colorblindness as a race strategy in Chester's growth, not just today, but you extend this back historically, as we'll discuss. But I was wondering if you can just talk briefly about what this means, this ideology of colorblindness as a race strategy, a specific strategy.
Right. So I guess after doing some work on, you know, why these particular forms of urban development were popping up within a short course of time in the 90s and the 2000s, I then began to do a bit more fine-tuned research in terms of archival, but primarily at that point, interviews. And what I was finding when I asked what was the logic that was going here in terms of what was being built from urban planners and from the entrepreneurial companies that were coming in and doing a lot of the planning, kind of paid consulting and things of this nature, is that they kept referring to these efforts as part of a larger project to create more diversity within Chester. And at first I thought that they were talking about diversity of use in terms of, again, there's a whole display of uses here, incarceration, gambling, sports and leisure, spectacle, and things of this nature, a lot of things that urbanists have been writing about. But what they were really talking about, as I pressed them further, was diversity in terms of the population that uses, enjoys, recreates, makes some form of presence in, whether as residents or visitors in Chester. And essentially, they were referring to an effort to try to expand the attraction and pull of Chester to the broader suburbs, which are majority white and wealthy. And they were using this discourse of how a significant part of Chester's problem in the recent past is that it lacked the kind of diversity that made cities, kind of tying into the creative cities impulse, that Chester lacked this. And it was interesting to me, as someone who's studied post-war cities, that this kind of discourse about race was being employed in a very, what I thought was a unique way. There's a film called My Brooklyn, a documentary by Kelly Anderson on the redevelopment of Fulton Mall in Brooklyn. And she outlines a similar kind of process, that she talks about how Fulton Mall was very much an economic success, catering to primarily African-American and Latino residents in Brooklyn. But the plans to that underwent to redevelop it ignored that element. And in the film, one of the urban planners says quite clearly that the problem is that it caters exclusively to minority residents, and that we need to remake Fulton Mall into something a bit more welcoming to others besides minorities. And I found this, and I find this still to be an interesting use of a discourse about the end of a kind of collective resonance of race as a claims making strategy of poor cities, of discrimination and segregation and structural problems, and turning it on its head to kind of individualize these consequences, that the individuals who live in these cities are sort of the byproducts or leftovers of failed strategies, and that the success is more likely if we move towards a strategy that integrates. So this is a discourse that's very popular in this kind of mixed communities research that people like Loretta Lees in the UK have been working on. And the Move to Opportunity program in the US, I guess, also taps into this idea that cities that historically deindustrialized have become kind of concentrated areas of poverty of mostly minority residents need to be broken up. And the infusion of middle-class white, primarily white ethos or kind of mentorship in a strange way would be the best means for revival. So this idea that came to me is this notion that, well, here we're seeing that race is not really being used in its kind of compositional or demographic form, but purely in a discursive notion of a diversity discourse that's being employed to legitimize the redevelopment. Because what was going on was a number of community actors in Chester and also in Camden, another city that I looked at, were making claims that the promises of economic development that casinos and stadiums bring are rarely borne out. And to counter these claims, the argument was being made, well, this is an effort to, again, try to open up the city to a much broader audience that includes white middle-class visitors at this point, but in the future, quite clearly, residents as well. And so I began to wonder, to what degree does race comprise or constitute some kind of strategy that entrepreneurs and city leaders and urban planners in efforts to either gentrify or redevelop deploy or employ in transformation of space? And so as I looked further and deeper into Chester, that was one of the things that I was convinced was going on, is that throughout the history of Chester, and I covered essentially since 1900, that race has been used as an effective strategy. And by race, I'm referring to explicitly the representation, the discourse around race that draws in dominant ideologies, at this point, color blindness, but in earlier times, of course, a bit more heinous notions of separation and racial superiority become deployed in a way in which space is allocated. And although people have written about this, obviously, at great length and structurally, I guess there's a couple of things that I try to accomplish by focusing on race as a strategy in terms of political economy and development.
Right, right. I think that's a real fascinating decision that you made in the book to use that strategy. So you talk a bit about how, while, you know, Chester really, in many ways, it follows that typical path of the post-war city: suburbanization, white flight, deindustrialization, degrees of gentrification. Your aim is to really focus on this idea of agency and intentionality over time in Chester, and to avoid some of those grand narratives that we've become very familiar with in urban research. Tell us a bit about that decision that you made to focus on more agency and intentionality as a way of understanding these grand narratives in a different way.
Yeah, this I really am convinced and remain excited about is that it's a combination of, I guess, my efforts at teaching urban sociology for the past 25 years, and obviously students who were born at this point much later than most of the things that are talked about in post-war narrative of deindustrialization and suburbanization. So to them, it's somewhat an abstraction. It's not obviously lived. Then I also, so there's that kind of was driving me to try to address this issue of the absence of agency and the absence of complexity within this narrative, and the way in which often, especially in mainstream sociology, in the sense of setting up discussions about things like neighborhood effects and setting up discussions about things discussions of urban concentrated poverty, that these things are provided in a very cursory way. They're not wrong by any stretch, but they hide a lot of the detail, the granular level of detail that I was interested in explaining to not only students, but also in this discussion of Chester. The second part of that decision was the archival work that I did in Chester. Not only was I finding that race was consistently playing the key card in how the city was transformed, but I was also finding that it was intentional, and that the granular level analysis of who was involved and who was making these decisions and how race became not epiphenomenal or even a consequence of some of these actions of, for example, to not build an all-black housing development privately owned in the immediate post-war period, or to not build an incinerator in the downtown area that would be controlled by the city itself, which was primarily African-American by the 1970s, but by the county, which is majority white, that there was a lot of, I guess the best way to put it was this kind of manipulation that was occurring at the politics of urban development that drew explicitly on racial categories and stigma, racial fears in particular. And these were not either coincidental or even incidental. They were explicit and intentional. And I kept finding this repeated within this archival research on Chester. So the book is trying to do, I guess, three things here, all related to this notion of race. I guess the first we already talked about, which is this notion of elevating race and representations of race to a kind of strategic element in the political economy of urban development. The second one was to kind of have in dialogue with these more structural grand narrative notions of post-war urban change, and to modestly interject an effort to return to granular level detail to bring out the complexity of that story for the sake of primarily freshmen who are coming in and seeing this as almost a sing-song narrative of ION words, gentrification, deindustrialization, these kinds of things, to bring it more to life and to remove some of the flattening of agency and intentionality. And then the third thing is the story itself. Chester is in many ways an extreme case of this continuous engagement with race, but mostly in a clearly negative way in the redevelopment and transformation of the city over time. And the peculiarities of what I found that really drove me in terms of the analysis of the importance of race, and again, highlighting these details, mostly duplicitous, mostly parasitic in terms of the way, in which, especially in the period of the 70s and 80s, the way in which a lot of the negative events and processes that were occurring around drugs and crime in the city that were superficially attributed to the presence of a majority black population, but clearly, through the analysis that I found, run by machine politics, leftovers of mostly, predominantly white politicians who essentially saw the opportunity to bilk the city and its connection to federal programs in particular as a way of lining pockets and at the expense of residents. And I think that this this focus in this particular period, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself here chapter-wise, in terms of talking about crime and corruption at the highest scales of local government, really needs to be addressed. I mean, I do only focusing on Chester, I think that there's a need to talk about the significance of corruption in the politics at the local level and how that intersects with race. I know, and I think we all know, that that's not unique to Chester, but it hasn't been fully enveloped in our understanding of a lot of the post-war processes.
Right, right. Well, I think it's a really fascinating decision, and you really show it historically quite well. And the chapters really proceed chronologically, and you trace the history of this racial tension and the rise of race to assign blame for social ills of urban growth to World War I. Before then, you show how the city's race relations seemed somewhat stable, and to a certain degree, relatively speaking, blacks even somewhat flourished there. So right. What was it about this era that led to this shift and to the rise of this intentionality?
So the early history of Chester, I should say quite clearly up front, is that what makes Chester somewhat unique is the longevity of the Republican political machine from the late 19th century up to 1965, which is somewhat extraordinary, running not only the city of Chester, but Delaware County, where it sits. And in the early stages of the city's pre-growth spurt related to World War I, like many cities, there was in the north, a stalemate in terms of what neighborhoods were considered to be African American, what neighborhoods were considered to be white. The population growth was nominally increased in the late 19th century. It wasn't until essentially when the black migration related to the two wars brought a number of African Americans from the South to industrial cities, that the population changes that occurred laid bare a lot of the underlying political processes that were keeping this stalemate in place. So Chester was, in this period, primarily a kind of a honky-tonk industrial city. It was a kind of bar district for the greater Delaware Valley. It stayed open later. The corruption of the political machine linked to alcohol and prostitution was clearly on display. The front side of it, however, was that these establishments were primarily run by lieutenants in the political machine who were African American. So there was a race riot in 1917 in Chester that basically the tensions underlying demographic changes and the notion that African Americans were in control of primarily the vice district in the city came to a boil. The resolution was the machine essentially embraced the strategy of separation that appealed to African Americans out of very little choice of their own, in the sense of creating a sense of control within black communities. So you had the development of a very extensive downtown district exclusively for African Americans, with obviously with stores and shops and things and schools. The career path to the middle class was primarily through education at segregated schools, again controlled by the Republican political machine in terms of appointments. So there was a carrot and stick approach. African Americans, as long as they stayed within the particular areas, were protected by the machine from the potential of white backlash. At the same time, were those who participated willingly in, so to speak, in the production of this spatial segregation were awarded in terms of their connection to patronage in the political machine. That begins to unfold as we get into the latter part of the 1940s and 1950s, primarily due to external forces related to the intervention of the federal government in terms of federal housing programs, but also in terms of the civil rights movement and the way in which it played out in Chester, which again was a test case for the relationship between the NAACP and its kind of efforts at trying to harness the young, more militant African-American civil rights activists. And this becomes kind of blows up in the period of the 1960s. So one of the clear efforts of manipulation of race and the that clearly shows intentionality is the period of 1963-64, when the city was embroiled in a number of demonstrations, pickets, boycotts related to primarily school segregation. And this was came all under the auspices of a kind of firebrand young man who came to town by the name of Stanley Branch, who at first worked within the local NAACP, which had been very effective in a gradual improvement of civil rights over the course from the 1930s to the 1960s. But Branch, not unlike many others in the civil rights era in the early 60s, wanted to take something a bit more in your face and embraced more strategies that we are somewhat familiar with in terms of the history of the civil rights movement, like sit-ins and pickets and demonstrations in town. So period of 63-64, this occurs. The title of the chapter that I talk about this is called The Birmingham of the North. That was what was attributed to Chester at this time. It created this schism within the civil rights movement. A number of the local civil rights advocates who were related to the NAACP were concerned about the pace and scale of these demonstrations. There was no end game in place. And just to jump forward, it turns out that Mr. Branch was not simply a firebrand civil rights activist who came to town and sparked some massive forms of demonstrations and protests, but he was essentially on the payroll of the local white elite political party. His ties, family ties with some of the members of Black Lieutenants who were part of the Republican machine. In essence, it becomes revealed. And one of the more interesting periods of doing research for this book was I was reading the NAACP archives from the Chester papers, and a number of the local, again, old guard civil rights activists had input in writing in their letters to the national office that there's something strange going on here. We don't know who this guy is, and we don't know why he never seems to get arrested. They seem to think that there was something untoward about his presence and how he was striking up a lot of action and a lot of activity. The national NAACP, however, was interested in creating this image of participation of young people, so was hesitant to criticize Stanley Branch. Long and short of it is that the strategy that the Republican Party was embracing was to try to percolate, in many ways, the civil rights activism within the city that exacerbated white fear. And in essence, you saw the effort, clearly, of the white political machine to try to facilitate the exodus of whites from what they saw was the inevitability of a demographic transition in the city of Chester to being primarily Black. And so there was an old guard, there's a number of old white working class neighborhoods that were holding on. And if you look at the chapter that I talk about this, and you see that these begin to fall almost a domino effect immediately following the racial unrest. So this is one of maybe two or three that I discussed in the book in which the quite obvious cynical manipulation of racial fear as a means and mechanism to facilitate. Now, I'm not suggesting that it caused, but it's definitely clear evidence that it facilitated, exacerbated this transition of what we all call white flight. Again, dating back to my earlier discussion about when this is presented to people today who are 18 to 20 years old, they feel that this is a sort of an era when people harbored racial animus and prejudice, and we have moved beyond that. I'm not suggesting that people who lived in Chester did not harbor those forms of animus and feeling and racist attitudes towards their neighbors. But I also want to emphasize to students, and this is one of the purposes of the chapter in the book, is that there's a more systematic approach that's going on here in the way in which race is being deployed as a means to further decisions that people were hesitant to make.
Right. I mean, I think the white flight narrative obviously is something that you really unpack quite well, I think, in this book, something that we've really taken for granted, and you really show how suburban growth was... it was really more of an expansion of racial division that was already occurring in the city, in Chester at the time.
Right. Yes, most definitely. And I argue that it's as you said, the scale shifts to the suburbs, and the urban suburban divide becomes a much larger version of what was already had occurred in the segregated spaces within the city itself.
Right. So then after these civil rights battles that you just talked about a little bit, we see some institutional decline, further disinvestment, more what we can call just popularly white flight. But you argue that the key to understanding Chester during this period of, I suppose, 1970s, 1980s, is a parasitic economy, you call it, that really emerged, that took advantage of the black population, that was fueled by this public discourse and rhetoric that pushed black cultural deficiencies to the fore as the cause of these problems that were occurring in black communities.
Right. So here, this is an interesting, I think, and this period is very close to my experience as growing up as a teenager, where again, the standard narrative was the concentration of poor black folks within inner cities of smaller deindustrial areas like Camden, Chester, Wilmington, Delaware, Baltimore, were essentially creating these zones in which drugs flourished, crime flourished, the whole discourse that's picked up even continues today about the welfare queen and this notion are on display here. I don't go into great detail about that. I'm much more interested in how this intersects with the politics of development at the time. As you said, by this point in urban history, we're talking about deindustrialization at a massive scale, Ford Motor Plant, the Pew Sun Oil Company. These were bulwarks of Chester's industrial past, have already long closed by the mid-70s, early 80s. And the city is essentially kind of reeling from the absence of any form of reliable employment base. At the same time that this is occurring, you see that the blame is placed squarely on the backs of the residents themselves. The as I outline in the chapter on that we're talking about called Five Square Miles of Hell, is that at the tail end of the racial unrest in the 60s, the state of Pennsylvania, and in line with the federal government, primarily the War on Poverty, used Chester as an explicit test case. Like many cities, which the grassroots movements and anti-poverty campaigns, in this case, the Greater Chester Movement, were harnessed as a means to funnel funds from federal and state levels to make meaningful impact at the local level. There was about a period of 18 months where this was quite effective in addressing a number of long-standing poverty issues in the city of Chester, especially around employment training. But as unfortunately the case was in many cities, these were harnessed by political elites. The funds were misappropriated. They were used again and funneled in through patronage systems so that family members and political allies were taking over positions related to social welfare. The Public Housing Authority in Chester is a great example of that. And in essence, became a way to, as I call it, a parasitic economy that flows coming in from the federal and state level were channeled in directly to elites, and that the impact lessened almost immediately after following this event in the early 1970s. And the Human Rights Commission from Pennsylvania did quite an extensive analysis on this and found quite clearly that this level of corruption reached from the regional level right down into, again, the local leaders and social service providers within the city of Chester. So what this narrative then of stigma does is it kind of shifts that discussion, that focus away from what are the mechanics of how this corruption is actually occurring to the individuals who are ostensibly the victims of this, but are nonetheless being portrayed as the perpetrators of it by virtue of their own behavioral actions, their lack of education, things of this nature that we well know as being kind of tied to the stigma of Black inner city culture. So this becomes, again, another way discursively of pushing the blame and the focus away from the actual actors themselves. The second part of this story that makes it a bit even stranger to this is the story about the incinerators. And I'll just very quickly suggest some comments on this. So in Chester, the first Black mayor is elected, and one of her main efforts at trying to get economic development is to build an incinerator that would essentially take care of all of Philadelphia's trash. And this was pitted against plans from the county to build an incinerator to get rid of all of Delaware County's trash. As I outlined in the story, the Black mayor's approach to having a city determined economic strategy is put forward as this kind of self-empowerment of African Americans and to try to counter this narrative of stigma. And a number of well-meaning residents and community activists buy into it. What it turns out to be, again, it documented in a very cynical way, it turns out to be primarily a ruse to take the eye off the ball of creating what becomes the largest waste industrial park on the East Coast that was built by the county. And again, I don't think I have the time to go into details, but here again, this is the case in which the mayor, who ended up, it turns out that she was the secretary of an earlier mayor who was convicted of racketeering, was playing into, again, cynically, manipulating these notions of Black self-empowerment for the purposes of, again, taking the eye off the ball of the fact of creating what became disastrous in terms of environmental consequences for the community itself. So this chapter, like the chapter on the race unrest, shows quite clearly in the way in which I attempt to document it, is how the intentionality of playing into a larger, broader discourse about race, in this case, the stigma of race, becomes an effective means to transform the city according to, again, the interest of mostly white elites, in this case, mostly white suburban elites. And that's brings us up into the present period, which is where we started.
Right. And this segues perfectly right back to the beginning, which is the revitalization, I guess you can call it, of Chester in the late 20th, early 21st century up until today. And that is the waterfront development, the casino, the soccer stadium. And it's in this concluding chapter where you return to this idea of colorblindness and how it gets used in these developments, which you refer to very cleverly in a turn of phrase as islands of renewal in a sea of decay. And the distinction between having community stakeholders versus having community shareholders, which I think is a very valuable way of looking at this. But talk a little bit more about specifically how this colorblindness takes place today in Chester with these developments.
So what I try to do in the final chapter is to outline what are the implications then of this effort, as I mentioned at the beginning of today, of trying to diversify, not by simply uses, but who's using these spaces, basically consumers, right? They're not residents at this point. So there is the casino has done fairly well. It initially was supposed to contribute to a much larger redevelopment of the adjacent area, but no one really expected that. We have Atlantic City and other cities to show us that it's most likely not going to happen, and it hasn't happened in Chester. The soccer stadium is successful, but again, that is a spectacle-oriented development that only attracts people when there is an event going on. My question was then, what was the implication for the residents that lived nearby? How are they being integrated into this form of this narrative of Chester rising? And in essence, they play either two roles. They are either impediments in the sense that they're standing in the way of by their very presence and behavior. And this is focused primarily on the criminal element, as it's called, that exists in Chester, that creates this image that pops up occasionally on the local news of this is still Chester, and the city's effort to try to eliminate that primarily through surveillance techniques borrowed somewhat from Camden, which has been a test case for using high-tech surveillance, gunshot detectors, and things of this nature to try to discipline the population in a kind of focus on the punitive elements of the criminal justice system. So there's the people who are the impediments, and then there's the others who are either low-wage workers that are employed, but very few, in the casino and or in the prison or in the soccer stadium. And so they're either participating as low-wage workers or they are simply not to be part of it. In essence, they are excluded. And so in essence, the way in which it individualizes the collective sentiment of the community, and that's what I try to get at, this notion of community shareholders, the effort to try to tap into what is it that folks that live there are trying to achieve and are interested in achieving. One thing that has happened since I put this book to bed is that the Avenue of the States, which is one of the former commercial streets in the city of Chester, has seen an effort by local artists to create what's called Made in Chester. And it's a very interesting and very hopeful process in which the individuals are very keen. They're very smart, very savvy. They do not want this to be an issue in which artists become the kind of incubators of gentrifiers who then eventually they themselves get displaced and this becomes, you know, another corporate mall. In essence, what they're doing is they're creating a kind of land bank effort to create spaces of art. They have a coffee shop, furniture store. They have a number of efforts that in formerly abandoned buildings. But they have an explicit agenda of more of a local social justice appeal to create a district that is meant for people who live in Chester and, of course, anyone else who wants to come visit, but that this is not a springboard towards some form of corporate development. So they're very keen. They're very political savvy in trying to make sure this doesn't happen. So the colorblindness issue obviously intersects with the idea that the future of Chester is a consumption-oriented spectacle entertainment city that addresses primarily the needs of the larger, broader community, especially Delaware County, and the residents themselves become sidelined. The grassroots effort that's occurring is to counter that narrative, and it remains to be seen where that will go.
Right, exactly. We'll see, I guess, where lot of other cities are going to be. Probably engaging with a lot of these questions and tensions. I just wanted to ask a quick methodological question. So a lot of your research was archival, but you mentioned how you started out by doing interviews with some, I think, city leaders and civic boosters. I'm just curious what some of the things, you know, what's some of the narratives that these folks said to you, if any of them at all recognize some of these tensions and issues? Did you speak to anybody in the African-American community, African-American leaders, and what some of their thoughts were on some of these new developments and the directions that Chester's going in?
Yeah, so for the first group, primarily city leaders, there was an organization called CEDA, which, like many cities, Chester essentially yielded its planning powers and its capacity to create a more citizen-oriented form of urban development, one that would be accountable to residents. They ceded that authority primarily to a public-private organization charged exclusively with entrepreneurial development, bringing in capital. Those folks speak to that effort almost exclusively. They seem to suggest that the residents will benefit by some measure down the line simply by attracting capital, mainly real estate capital, back into the city itself. So that's an interesting development because, again, the only way that local leaders saw that happening was, again, to essentially cede that to a third party. And that those folks who I interviewed with were the proponents of this notion of this city is in many ways too minority and an effort to try to open it up. That was the language for them. Local leaders from the African-American community in particular saw a mixed benefit in this, in that the effort to try to redevelop the city has always been on the forefront, especially since the debacle of deindustrialization effects in the 1970s. So they were very welcome to many of these efforts. But there's always been a great degree of skepticism in terms of how this is going to pan out and play for the folks who live, as they say, across 291, which is the industrial highway that separates the waterfront from the city proper. So they their effort is to try to constantly garner some leverage in how these deals are made out. But they have turned more inward, primarily because they understand that the waterfront has been, again, essentially ceded to this third party that has control over the land. The county in particular has deals to cede county-owned property to property developers for a nominal sum, and they abate the property and build these kinds of complexes like the soccer stadium from out-of-town concerns. So in essence, the effort along Avenue of the States is reflective of more of these a combination of the skepticism of project-based redevelopment that's occurring along the waterfront, but also more of an organic grassroots effort at trying to take the reins of redevelopment up on the individuals themselves within the community and look more inwardly. There's been a similar effort. If I can just jump in real quick and make a plug for Buffalo. There was an effort to redevelop the waterfront, mainly from external large corporations, to build sort of like a Bass Pro fishing outlet that's supposed to prompt some form of transformation. That fell through. A number of local activists turned to the city and said, give us a chance, and it's become somewhat highly successful, actually, in that it's oriented towards local individuals as opposed to this abstract notion of the successful white middle-class gentrifier who's going to come in and save the day. So in essence, we see a similar thing occurring in Chester. And again, it's very early on, but there is quite clearly an effort to try to, as I say at the end of the book, to try to transform the narrative too, away from the hapless, passive victim to being someone who, the residents who are being very fully integrated and try to control the narrative of development, which is a very difficult task at this day and age in terms of the way public-private partnerships have really taken that discourse of diversity and played it up.
Right. Yeah. Interesting parallels. And I guess we'll wait and see what unfurls. So we have taken up a lot of your time already. I was wondering before we conclude if you would just tell us a little bit about what you've been working on. You touched on it a little bit, but what have you been doing next, and how does it build from what you've been doing with this book in Chester?
Well, I guess one of the things that I've been working on recently is looking at this area called Regent Park in Toronto. So Regent Park is right east of downtown Toronto. It's very centrally located. Toronto is undergoing this massive paced gentrification. I read recently the largest number of high-rise condominium buildings going up in North America. So Regent Park was the first public housing development and largest in Canada, built in the post-war period, primarily to Irish working class, became increasingly occupied by immigrant communities, especially from South Asia and the Caribbean. And I was in effort about 10 years ago to transform this space associated again with the stigma of crime and racial poverty into a mixed income community. So in essence, cross-subsidized. So sell some of the units, demolish everything, build new structures as condominium complex, and use the funds to subsidize the production of low-income housing as a replacement. So the story is pretty standard, as one would expect. That hasn't really played out as anticipated. There aren't as many units as promised. But the part that I'm interested in, again, is the way in which this has been sold, and an effort to try to kind of create this ideal notion of white middle class colonizers are somehow going to provide mentorship skills and social capital to residents who have been essentially cut off or isolated due to the production of the public housing project. My take and focus has been by interviewing people who have been displaced because they've been tracked, is that there were strong social networks that were in play that had evolved over the years, sort of imbricated with a lot of the social problems around crime in particular and poverty that made do, that these have been kind of pulled apart and torn asunder and made very difficult to be replaced. And so the what I'm trying to work on at this point is this kind of colliding narratives of here are people who are isolated, abandoned, and disenfranchised, and basically positioned as victims who will benefit from white middle class colonization, versus a narrative of the what's occurring more at the level of the ground, in which here is a community that did suffer by far a number of significant social problems, but have become very wild at figuring out ways to create networks amongst residents, especially that crossed both ethnicity and race, and in essence created a very viable grassroots social capital community-oriented community. That became because this project is being pulled apart over time, and as sociologists, it's a unique opportunity to get to see this, unfortunate as it may be, but these networks are being torn apart in the very process, and so this again, the question of whether or not this is again the use of a narrative of inclusion and diversity that's definitely being at play here in terms of the redevelopment of Regent Park, is again an effort to what Loretta Lees calls gentrification by stealth, which is this kind of effort to make it feel good gentrification that at the end of the day displaces a large number of people, but also the networks that they formed.
Really interesting. And you're right, as sociologists, we don't often get to study, especially as urban sociologists, we don't get to study these events in real time or to trace the displaced, but seems you're right there. Fortunately for you, unfortunately for the people involved, obviously. But fascinating stuff. Yeah. And hopefully when you eventually write up that book, you can come back and we can discuss it.
Yeah, be great.
All right, I want to thank you, Chris, for coming on. Really great stuff.
Good, thank you for having me.